turn to the left to signal their displeasure, or to the right if they're entertained. These famous dial tests might be accurate measurements of a show's pilot, but they aren't always great measurements of a show's potential. Seinfeld was not a great test, said Sumi Berry, Senior Vice President of Consumer and Market Intelligence at NBC. Neither was Friends. The Office had an awkward first screen test, but then we put it behind My Name is Earl, and it took off. Some of the most famous shows in broadcast history did not debut fully formed, like Athena springing from the head of Zeus. They were more like ordinary children, born helpless and slowly reaching maturity. When Cheers debuted on NBC on September 30th, 1982, at 9 p.m., it finished last in its time slot. Out of 77 shows that premiered in the 1982-83 season, its dismal ratings placed it in the 70s. But the show was critically acclaimed, and if NBC had canceled it, there wouldn't have been many suitable replacements. Cheers survived to year two, but it still wasn't a hit. But NBC showed patience. Executives knew they had an award show darling and thought perhaps it would slowly build an audience to match its critical reception. Finally, in its third season, the show's average ratings perked up. In 1985, Cheers began an 8-year run as one of the top 10 shows on TV. Hits have what economists call multiplier effects. If you introduce $1 into an economy, it can produce more than $1 of GDP growth. The same is true of hits. Growth begets growth. Popularity begets popularity. The value of a hit television show is greater than its ratings or its ad rates alone, because those don't account for an even more important feature, their ability to support other shows. The spillover effects of NBC's patience in the mid-1980s were massive. The obvious dividend was that Cheers launched a spin-off, Frasier, based on the character of Frasier Crane, a sonorous psychiatrist. Frasier debuted as a top 10 show in 1993 and went on to be perhaps the most successful TV spin-off, commercially and critically, of all time. But Cheers' subtler beneficiary was the immortal, loquacious sitcom Seinfeld. In the late 1980s, when NBC tested the show's pilot with 400 households, the response was worse than lukewarm. No segment of the audience was eager to watch the show again, the NBC pilot tester reported. But several executives loved its conversational pitter-patter. The network opted to air a one-episode special called The Seinfeld Chronicles, in the summer dead zone of 1989. It was a critical curiosity with mediocre ratings. For the next year, nothing much happened. Then the cancellation of a Bob Hope special freed up money for a 4-episode run the following summer. The episodes did surprisingly well. No surprise. They aired behind reruns of Cheers. The typical sitcom is a predictable hopscotch between small domestic problems followed by much hugging and learning. Seinfeld's writers, however, would have none of this. They wore jackets embroidered with the show's one and only rule: no hugging, no learning. But this pure and unsentimental vision took time to pay off. Even in its third season, the show got walloped by its competition, like ABC's Home Improvement, and finished a dismal 40th among primetime shows. But in the fall of 1993, NBC moved Seinfeld behind its thoroughbred comedy Cheers on Thursday nights. It was only then that everybody started watching the show about nothing. Buoyed by the audience of Cheers, Seinfeld soared in the ratings from the 40th to the 5th most-watched show on television. The rest of the story is lore. In its last 5 years, Seinfeld was one of the most popular shows on television, and TV Guide named it the greatest show of all time. Some might argue that Seinfeld's genius is platonic, an objective example of the presence of godly perfection on Earth. I would. But without Cheers to help launch it into the cultural pantheon, would anybody have tuned in to find out? One could draw a sentimental conclusion from this story. For example, that business people are always rewarded for following their hearts. But this isn't that kind of book. No hugging. And this isn't that kind of story. Cheers was above all a beneficiary of its time, when critically acclaimed comedies were scarce and networks rarely canceled original shows after a year. Even in the early 2000s, more than 90% of original series on broadcast and cable were renewed the following season. In 2015, however, the number of original shows has exploded, and now only 40% of them survive to see another year. There is practically no chance that NBC would renew the 400th most popular show in today's era of television abundance. But perhaps another lesson is about the rewards of betting on talent over outcomes, or people over products. The truth is that extending Cheers in 1983 and 1984, when it was one of the least popular shows on television, was a commercially dubious decision, and a broadcast television network might not make the same one today. But NBC didn't rush its writers. It believed in its showrunners as individuals. The network gave them time to develop characters and relationships. Because NBC made the decision in 1983 to extend a show that nobody was watching, the channel spent two decades with some of the most popular and critically celebrated comedies ever. The last episodes of Cheers, Seinfeld, and Frasier are among the 15 most watched finales in television history. The definition of broad in broadcast has narrowed in the last few decades as the number of cable channels and original shows has bloomed. The 40-40-20 rule for hits has depreciated to something more like a 30-30-20 rule. A network can have a broad hit on its hands, with just 2% of the country feeling passionate about its debut. In 2000, there were 125 original scripted series and fewer than 300 unscripted cable series, or reality shows. By 2015, there were 400 original scripted series and nearly 1,000 original reality series, and across the board tripling. One can see the effect in Nielsen ratings, which estimate the percent of TV-owning households that watch a given program. For a show to have a Nielsen rating of 20 means that one-fifth of homes with a television are watching it. In 1979, 26 shows surpassed that lofty threshold. In 1999, only two shows hit the mark, ER and Friends. In 2015, none did. As television watching options expanded, the threshold for hits lowered. Cable networks invaded the television landscape with a different business model. They don't make most of their revenue from advertising. Instead, a cable network makes most of its money from fees paid out of each household's monthly cable bill for the legal rights to distribute their channel. If a family pays about $100 for cable each month, approximately $40 of it is divided among hundreds of channels. ESPN gets more than $7 per month, the most of any network. A news channel like CNN gets about 60 cents. This small fee, multiplied across the entire country, adds up to an enormous sum of money, tens of billions of dollars to support more entertainment than anybody can reasonably consume in several lifetimes. Cable has been the closest thing that the United States has had to a private sector tax. Just as 150 million tax-paying households fund a bundle of services called the U.S. government, 100 million cable-owning households have funded this bundle of entertainment, even if many of the programs don't serve their particular demographic. Young urban workers subsidize Medicare and farm subsidies. Young cable households subsidize Fox News and Green Bay Packers games. In 2005, Rob Sorcher was the executive vice president of programming at a cable channel that most people knew as American Movie Classics. The network had recently changed its name to AMC, But like the surviving actresses in its black and white films, this facelift alone was insufficiently rejuvenating. The channel was struggling mightily and in danger of being dropped by cable operators like Comcast and Time Warner Cable. This would have been ruinous, since the first business of a cable network is to stay on the bundle. Sorcher wasn't looking for a broad show with mass appeal like a raunchy family comedy for Fox. He wanted something that couldn't be copied. As he said, your strategy becomes, let's go for quality. Sorcher came across an intriguing script by a writer for the HBO mafia family drama, The Sopranos. The writer's name was Matthew Weiner. Both sides had every reason not to work together. Weiner knew that AMC was a channel without renown or money and might give his show the worst possible exposure. For AMC, this was a slow show about sad and unlikable people in the 1960s world of advertising by someone with no record as a successful showrunner. But they made a deal anyway, because AMC was devoted to making a distinctive show that would ensure its place in the cable bundle. The show was Mad Men. Mad Men was precisely the sort of television that Sorcher wanted. Beautiful and strange, a shadowy, intimate drama with cinematic touches and methodical pacing. It was not a blockbuster hit by audience size. The show averaged fewer than 1 million viewers in its first season, less than a show that might be abruptly canceled on a broadcast network like NBC. But AMC didn't need a blockbuster hit. It needed a unique show appealing to a critical mass of valuable viewers so that no major cable company would think of leaving AMC off the bundle. Ultimately, it's almost wrong to say that AMC made money from the few million people who watched Mad Men. The channel really made money from the tens of millions of households who never watched Mad Men, but nonetheless paid a few dollars every year for AMC through their cable bills. One little hit had a massive multiplier effect. Mad Men helped to rescue an entire network. The difference between broadcast and cable speaks to a critical lesson for picking hits. Artistic judgment can go hand in hand with economic savvy. Mad Men's ratings were so low that it might have been canceled after 1 year on NBC, but on AMC it was a hit. Not strictly because of the size of its audience, but because of the business model that it clicked into. In the last decade, the cable channel FX has arguably produced the deepest lineup of prestige drama and critically acclaimed comedy on cable, including The Shield, Nip Tuck, Damages, American Horror Story, Archer, Fargo, Louie, The League, Justified, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, The Americans, and Sons of Anarchy. Their genres span surrealist horror, dark biker drama, and verbose spy comedy. I'm looking for a 90-hour movie, a novelistic character journey, said Nicole Clemens, executive vice president for series development at FX. Genre is irrelevant. It's just a Trojan horse carrying the deeper emotional question. Who is the main character becoming? What is he or she going to do next? Clemens describes herself as a former latchkey child, raised in the glow of television in the 1970s, with shows like Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley. She can remember the day she was deemed old enough to stay up and watch The Love Boat. Clemens first went to work in film, but she found that the middle class of movies was being hollowed out. Some movie makers went to work on franchise films that cost hundreds of millions of dollars, while others toiled on small indie films. But the middle left for cable, and in 2012, Clemens followed them for television. The key to success for us is to find an authentic, original voice and characters so compelling that the audience wants to wear their skin, she said. That is, FX is looking for superheroes and antiheroes, but they don't have to wear a cape or even a $5,000 suit. I define a hero as somebody who can do what we can't do, she said. That would include a brave fireman, but also a sociopath. Aaron Sorkin's characters are all superheroes. They can't leap tall buildings in a single bound, but they can talk and think better than ordinary humans. The second principle at FX is what Clemens calls the hide-the-vegetables-and-potatoes approach to storytelling. Like George Lucas festooning his evergreen myths with glittery technology, Clemens sees the value of old stories wearing new costumes. In Sons of Anarchy, its popular drama about an outlawed motorcycle club, you think it's this super uber macho motorcycle show, but it's also a soap with handsome guys. And the plot is basically Hamlet. In The Americans, the critically acclaimed spy drama about Soviet agents posing as a married couple in the United States, you crash in the middle of the Cold War, and meet this spy couple who has been in an arranged marriage for 10 years. They've just started to fall in love, but they have to kill people and sleep with other people. So the spy genre has been subverted to tell a classic story about marriage. A third business category within television is subscription-only channels, like Netflix and premium networks like HBO and Showtime. It sounds risky to forego advertising, but this business model is an artistic luxury. If somebody pays for HBO, it doesn't matter if she watches 50 hours a week or never watches at all. HBO makes the same amount of money. The company doesn't have to worry about maximizing ratings each hour to lure advertisers. NBC studies audience data with Talmudic exegesis because its business model encourages a devotion to delighting the largest possible audience. HBO does not rely on dial testing, focus groups, or surveys, its executives told me, because its business model requires something subtler. Its economic imperative is to build a television product that viewers feel like they have to pay for even when they don't watch it. HBO is in a different business than broadcast, said Michael Lombardo, HBO's former president of programming. The broadcast channels are selling eyeballs and advertising. HBO is not in the business of selling tickets. HBO is selling a brand. No audience would tell a television network to make a show about neurotic, narcissistic young women flailing in their early 20s, he told me. But when HBO made that very show, Lena Dunham's Girls, it debuted as a critical darling and might have been the most written about show on television. To what end would I focus group that show, Lombardo said, so that Hannah would be nicer to her friends? HBO's first two hit original drama series, The Sopranos and 6 Feet Under, were dark, strange, and too explicit for broadcast television or cable. Several broadcast networks turned down David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, before he accepted HBO's promise of creative latitude. That is HBO's long game, to build a reputation as a place where creative geniuses have artistic freedom. That strategy might not produce a hit each year, but over time, serious television viewers will feel obligated to pay HBO for the expectation of forthcoming genius, even if it doesn't always materialize. In this way, a company like HBO is more like a talent management agency than a typical television channel. The network's thesis is, find the best artists, give them time and space to create, and distribute their creation. When Lombardo first read the script for Game of Thrones in 2006, he worried it would be an impossible haul for his company. The series would be based on George R.R. Martin's best-selling doorstop books about several families battling for power in a fantasy universe similar to J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle Earth. But the price could be prohibitive. The 10-hour film trilogy of The Lord of the Rings, directed by Peter Jackson, had cost about $300 million to make. HBO would have to produce 10 hours of similar entertainment year after year. A part of me thought, we shouldn't be doing a show with dragons and White Walkers, Lombardo told me. I was concerned that we couldn't afford a production that would have to rival those feature films, and HBO had no record of successfully doing this genre. One afternoon, as Lombardo was undecided on the script, he stopped by the Santa Monica Equinox gym, a few blocks from the beach. He was walking through the cardio section when he saw Dan D.B. Weiss, one of the two lead writers on the Game of Thrones pilot, hunched over an incline bike, reading a copy of the original George R.R. Martin book with copious annotations. Lombardo approached Weiss to say hello. They chatted for a few minutes. He was holding a highlighter in his hands, Lombardo told me, and the book was absolutely covered in notes and dog ears. That's what HBO wants. To bet on that sort of commitment and passion, the sort that inspires an obsessive-compulsive approach to adapting a fantasy epic for a network that doesn't do fantasy. Whatever reservations I had, they were gone. I thought, these guys aren't swinging for the easy hit. They're doing this because they love these stories. In January 2007, Lombardo and HBO optioned the series. 8 years later, Game of Thrones knocked off The Sopranos to become HBO's most watched show of all time. Perhaps even more impressively, it holds another superlative that speaks to its global popularity. It is the most illegally downloaded show in the world. People often compare business to baseball. In both activities, one can mostly fail 70% of the time and still be an all-time great. But the difference between baseball and business is that baseball has what Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos cleverly called a truncated outcome distribution. Home runs can only be so big. In a letter to shareholders, he wrote, "When you swing, no matter how well you connect with the ball, the most runs you can get is 4. In business, every once in a while, when you step up to the plate, you can score 1,000 runs. This long-tail distribution of returns is why it's important to be bold. Big winners pay for so many experiments." The Sopranos was no ordinary home run. It wasn't just the most watched show in the history of HBO for its time. It also increased subscriptions to the premium cable channel by 50%. Mad Men wasn't just a critical gem, it also led to AMC picking up Breaking Bad, one of the most acclaimed shows in TV history, and the network's cable fee revenue rose 50% between 2007 and 2013. This growth in fees helped the network produce The Walking Dead, which became the most popular drama on cable. The risky bets on The Sopranos and Mad Men didn't just earn their parent companies a ton of money. They also sparked a commercial and artistic revolution on television. The genre of prestige television, which was once a monarchy overseen by HBO, is now a raucous parliament. Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, Showtime, Cinemax, Stars, FX, AMC, USA, and more compete for television shows that will be the next Sopranos or Mad Men, a critical juggernaut with cinematic panache and the expansiveness of an old-fashioned doorstop novel. Some hits save their company. A special few revolutionize their business. They score 1,000 runs. One of the hard things about writing a representative book about successful cultural products is that hits are not representative. They are intrinsic freaks, outliers, and exceptions. There is no complete and perfect formula for building a popular product. If there were, everybody would know and follow it, and the world would be awash in similarly successful cultural products, which technically means nothing would be very successful. Instead, the entertainment landscape is awash in imitation. Comic book sequels chasing comic book sequels, young adult fantasy novels piled upon young adult fantasy novels. Imitation is not a sign that people know the secret of popularity. It is a sign that there is no secret, and the only thing people know is the last thing that succeeded. Hit is a relative term. Not only within the television business, but also across entertainment. Best-selling books, blockbuster films, and online videos can all claim the title of hit, but their commercial popularity can differ by orders of magnitude. If a book sells 100,000 copies, it might be a national bestseller. But if a major studio film sells 100,000 tickets, yielding a domestic box office of around $1 million, it's a disgraceful flop. Meanwhile, if a studio film sells 100 million tickets worldwide, it might be one of the highest-grossing movies ever. But a YouTube video with 100 million views isn't historic at all. The most popular music videos on the platform can amass more than 1 billion views each year. An ebook might cost $10 and a movie ticket might cost $10. But underneath the price tag, the economics of books and movies couldn't be more different. A major movie studio, like 20th Century Fox, might churn out about 20 films a year and spend about $100 million on production and marketing for each one. A major publisher, like HarperCollins, might publish 10,000 books a year, almost more titles each week than 20th Century Fox will release in this decade. Both companies are in the business of selling stories, feelings, inspiration, and information. But they stay in the business by aligning costs with demand. 20th Century Fox survives in an industry where a handful of products require 10 million customers. And HarperCollins survives in an industry where almost nothing sells more than 1 million copies. HBO, AMC, FX, Republic Records, 20th Century Fox, HarperCollins, and other hit-making companies are all venture capitalists. They evaluate an enormous pool of products. They bet on a diverse set of potential hits, but success is semi-chaotic. Most ideas fail, and ideally the few successes pay off enough to compensate for the failure. Michael Lombardo and Nicole Clemens have had their share of Cassandra moments, but they are not Greek oracles. Their success begins with a business model that provides a steady stream of revenue to their companies, even in the case where they produce a season of entertainment that almost nobody watches. "We are in the brand play," Lombardo told me. "AMC is a brand. FX is a brand. NBC is still about selling a half-hour slot." Cable television might have been one of the best business models in modern media, a multi-billion dollar entertainment subsidy from 100 million households for hundreds of channels, despite the fact that most families never watched most channels. But many signs suggest that the near future will be different. Cable is in structural decline, with young audiences cutting the cord or never even plugging in. The future won't be one bundle for all, but rather many bundles for many. HBO, Netflix, Amazon Video, Hulu, and soon, maybe, a Disney bundle, a CBS bundle, and a sports bundle. There will be so much high-quality television and digital video series in the near future that audiences will clamor for a product that finds and organizes the best stuff across all these discrete services. In other words, it will be time for a new bundle. This seems to me the very likely future of video. The rebundling of unbundled bundles, which will inevitably be unbundled themselves. As the monolithic cable bundle disintegrates, it will fall to younger companies to learn what audiences are willing to pay for. Workers in some industries, like journalism and art, occasionally shudder at the pressure to monetize their work. It's always nice to think of creators working in a separate universe from the oleaginous world of commerce. But everybody has to eat. Claude Monet painted for about 60 years. That's 22,000 dinners, with many thanks to his heroic art dealer Paul Durand-Ruel and his friend and benefactor, Gustave Caillebotte. Monet had the freedom to be a dedicated artist because somebody else was his dedicated merchant. David Chase and Matthew Weiner relished artistic freedom because HBO and AMC had an economic model that allowed them, even encouraged them, to take risks. Art may be invaluable, but it's not free. One way or another, someone has to pay. Chapter 11. What the People Want, Part 2. A History of Pixels and Ink. What people want from the news is often not the news. Writing in the 21st century might be the most competitive industry in human history. The barriers are low, the supply is massive, and the competition is global, with countless publishers producing content for a global audience. Every day, writers compose several million news articles and blog posts, along with hundreds of millions of messages on Twitter and Facebook. But how many of these trillions of gigabytes are something anybody actually wants to read? To seek the unvarnished truth is the first and perhaps only objective of journalism. But news is a business, and a wise publisher seeks a, hopefully, complementary metric, the pleasure of its readers. Figuring out how to delight readers and audiences might seem like a simple investigation, but understanding what people actually want in the world of art and ideas is anything but straightforward. In fact, audiences are so curious and complicated that the most successful methods of studying their behavior are often indistinguishable from anthropology. So let's go back to the first anthropological study of readers, almost 100 years ago, in yet another age when it seemed like the world was hopelessly awash in words. The 1920s were a golden age of reading, and the spine of American bibliophilia ran down Fourth Avenue, south of Union Square, in Manhattan. This was Book Row, a cluster of 48 independent bookstores along six slender blocks. Today, the storefronts are all gone, except for one of the most famous independent bookstores in America. Appropriately for a solitary survivor, it's called The Strand. It was a fine decade for the budding of bookstores. The number of books published each year doubled between the 1910s and 1920s, to 10,000 unique titles. But the volume of pulp wasn't the most impressive thing about the decade's literature. The 1920s gave us F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, Ernest Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises, and William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. The European imports included James Joyce's Ulysses, Franz Kafka's The Trial, and Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway. It was a time for drearily faithless poetry with T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, and for inspirationally faithful fiction with the publication of Siddhartha and The Prophet. One of history's great mystery writers handed off the baton to another. Agatha Christie's first book, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, arrived in 1920, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's final volume of new Sherlock Holmes stories was published 7 years later. With thousands of titles flowing through the book rows of 1920s America, discovery became a fashionable problem, and new organizations rose to solve it. The Book of the Month Club, born in 1926, promised to handpick only the best works for its select members. The very next year, it got competition in the book subscription business from the Literary Guild of America. Neither organization is praised as an innovator today, but their business model anticipated a century of selling bundled content. Paying a greatly discounted per-unit price to get more stuff than you could reasonably consume is cable TV, Spotify, Netflix, and the modern subscription box business. What made the 20s such rollicking years for the printed word? A plausible explanation must include education, technology, and politico-economic fortuity. The share of men and women with a high school degree surged from about 30% in 1900 to about 70% in 1930, and the demand for news and entertainment for this educated workforce soared. Over the next century, the center of gravity in American news would shift to radio, television, computers, and mobile phones. But for a while, ink and paper enjoyed a brief media monopoly. Finally, the 1920s were a peaceful and prosperous period compared with the war and recession that bookended the decade. Depending on your perspective, journalism either benefited or outright bloated in this golden age of paper. A litter of iconic magazines was born, which included Time in 1923 and The New Yorker in 1925, and magazine advertising revenue rose by 500% in the decade. Yet the arrival of new periodicals and extraordinary works of literature hardly seemed to quench readers' thirst for daily publications. Newspaper sales also rose by 20% in the 1920s to 36 million copies a day. That worked out to 1.4 newspapers for every home. At one point, New York City had 12 daily papers all to herself. The first decades of the 20th century also witnessed the aggressive spawning of a new product, the tabloid. Like so many things in the history of American letters, the tabloid was a British import. Originating in late 1800s medicine, the word tabloid first referred to a small tablet of drugs. It soon became a catch-all for a smaller, compressed form of anything, including journalism and newspapers. The godfather of tabloid news was the great British media mogul Alfred Harmsworth, the founder and owner of the Daily Mail in London, which debuted in 1896. With shorter articles, populist pluck, and a halfpenny price, one halfpenny cheaper than its rivals, the Daily Mail was a sensation in Great Britain. By 1900, it was the first newspaper in the world to claim a circulation of more than 1 million. Unexpectedly, for a pioneer in pithy vulgarity, Harmsworth was grandiose, placing his growing media empire in the sweep of history. "We are entering the century of combination and centralization," he wrote. "The world enters today upon the 20th, or time-saving, century. I claim that by my system of condensed or tabloid journalism, hundreds of working hours can be saved each year." Thus, the tabloid was conceived not merely as a digest of smut, but also as a time-saving technology. Tabloids focused on sports, gossip, and above all, crime. A 1927 study showed that they devoted nearly one-third of their inches to crime stories, 10 times more than traditional papers. The first U.S. tabloid, inspired by Harmsworth's Daily Mirror, was the Illustrated Daily News, which launched in New York in June 1919. By the 1940s, it was the best-selling newspaper in the United States. By degrees, the tabloid ethos colonized even the most venerable papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times, which beefed up on ball games and blood to keep up with readers' evolving, or some might have argued, devolving, tastes. It was an era of growing pains for America's largest newspapers. The late 1800s had seen an explosion of smaller papers tailored for specific classes, languages, and ethnicities. New York and New Jersey alone were home to L'Eco d'Italia, L'Observatore Imparcial, Armenia Times, Norway Tidings, and Der Yiddischer Journal, the Jewish Journal, among other ethnic papers. The Kanajahari Radii, founded by a deaf-mute teacher named Levi Bacchus, initially focused on news for the deaf. This level of specialization meant that, say, Italian-American reporters were writing for Italian-American readers, who were sometimes their own Italian-American neighbors. Journalists were members of their own audiences, and editors did not have to agonize over what to put in the paper, since writing for one's readers often meant writing for oneself. But the papers of the early 20th century were a different beast altogether. National rather than local, pluralistic rather than purely ethnic. Urbanization encouraged smaller papers to consolidate. The invention of the telegraph and the syndication of news brought far-flung stories to local readers. The business of newspapers was changing, but so was the basic charge of journalism. As newspapers got bigger, editors were responsible for reaching a massive and diverse group of readers they didn't know at all. Writing for one's audience no longer meant writing for one's neighbors. It meant writing for hundreds of thousands of strangers. These technological and cultural changes forced editors and publishers to come up with a new approach to an old question. What do readers want? Newspapers had all sorts of ways to measure the demands of their readership in the early 1900s, but each was flawed and some were preciously primitive. Circulation records could tell publishers the size of their audience, but not where readers looked when they opened the bundle. Complaints and responses, for example, letters to the editor, were an honest source of feedback, but a vocal minority of readers offered a caricature of a paper's true readership. Publishers stooped to absurd tactics to find out what people were reading. To learn what features were most popular, some papers hired private investigators to sneak up behind readers to mark the articles they were looking at. Other publishers sent spies onto trains and trolleys to record the exact page that discarded papers were left open on the floor. This was a horrid way to measure readership, since it didn't say whether people enjoyed the page before exiting the train in a hurry, or hated the story so much they flung it to the ground in disgust. But desperate times called for trolley trawling. The golden age of reading was still in the stone age of understanding readers. Then along came a man whose name is now synonymous with public opinion. He offered a beguilingly simple plan to figure out what people want. Go into their living rooms, he said, and just watch them. George Gallup dreamed of being a professional newspaper editor. But when he graduated from the University of Iowa in 1923, he joined the school's PhD program in applied psychology. 5 years later, he published a dissertation that united his dream and his degree by studying readers as if they were research subjects. Gallup was no sentimentalist when it came to the Fourth Estate. He saw newspapers principally as gladiators in the arena of attention. The problem of the modern newspaper is to fit itself as nearly as it can to the needs of the reading public, he wrote. Specifically, its problem is to get itself read. This was not a rousing avowal of journalism's civic duty, and yet it had merit. A paper without readers is destined to be bankrupt, and a well-reported story is of little use if nobody reads it. Gallup was ahead of his time in understanding that newspapers' competition didn't just come from the pulpy inventions of his era, like tabloids and weekly magazines. It came from anything that required the attention of potential readers. Among the newspaper's rivals, he included radio, the burgeoning film industry, and even time spent driving in a car. His 1928 dissertation was titled An Objective Method for Determining Reader Interest in the Content of a Newspaper. Gallup's emphasis was squarely on the adjective objective. He was dismissive of circulation and publishers' pathetic attempts to dispatch secret agents to spy on readers. He was even skeptical of questionnaires. Instead, he proposed an ethnographical approach that he called the Iowa method. Intent on observing families in their own living rooms and kitchens, he sent interviewers into Iowans' homes to sit across a table from subscribers. Researcher and reader would flip through the Iowa papers together, from the top story on the front page to the cartoons, marking each headline, paragraph, and image as read or unread. Gallup suspected that readers often lied in surveys, so he instructed his team to ignore statements like, "I read the whole front page," or "I read nothing but the comics," because, he wrote, "Almost without exception, later questioning proved these preliminary statements false. The person who believes he has read all of the front page may not have read a fourth part of it. Gallup meticulously recorded his interview data across dozens of pages. He considered how working male readers differed from women and how farmers treated the newspaper differently from urban families. He determined that hard news on the front page was no more popular than some soft features buried in the back of the paper. The most read item wasn't news at all. It was the front page cartoon by J.H. Darling, read by 90% of men, compared with just 12% reading the day's local government news. For women, the most read parts of the newspaper were style and beauty pictures. Today's media critics offer trendy warnings about journalism drowning under Facebook, cable news, and the deluge of social media. But the typical newsreaders of the 1920s didn't crave long-form coverage of arcane yet politically consequential international reportage. Men in the 1920s liked funny pictures, and the women liked pretty photos. The idea of doing product research by watching people in their kitchens might not seem jaw-dropping, but it was subtly revolutionary. Gallup was a pioneer in what some now call applied anthropology, the use of anthropology to solve a practical human problem. In the 1930s, the U.S. government hired its first applied anthropologists to study Indian reservations to implement the Indian Reorganization Act of the New Deal. In the 1980s, Xerox PARC, Palo Alto's idea factory, employed anthropologists to design prototypes for the modern computer. Today, consulting firms like IDEO and McKinsey often begin projects by dispatching young employees to observe clients and consumers in their natural environments, their offices, kitchens, cars, and living rooms. After the U.S. government, the second largest employer of anthropologists today in the United States isn't Harvard University or UCLA. It's Microsoft. Gallup's methods made him a marketing celebrity in the 1930s. He joined the ad agency Young and Rubicam and applied his approach to print advertising in the depths of the Great Depression. Gallup changed the way publishers thought about white space, surprising fonts, and large images. For example, based on close interviews with readers, Gallup concluded that ads placed beneath the fold, in the bottom half of a newspaper page, were often ignored. He also found that readers pay more attention to photos than words. Gallup eventually applied his methods to politics, where his surname became a widely known brand in the arena of public opinion. Today, journalists and researchers often refer to Gallup surveys and polls on everything from worker engagement to racial attitudes and presidential elections. But there is an important distinction between these two services. Surveys measure present feelings and behavior. Are you a registered Republican? Polls forecast future election results. Will you vote for the Republican in next year's election? The distinction between surveys, a measure of the present, and polls, a measure of the future, points to a second lesson of Gallup's Iowa method. People are good at telling you their feelings, but they're less dependable at reporting their habits, particularly their bad habits, or projecting their future wants and needs. Iowa readers were untrustworthy reporters of their own behavior, but so are most people. Ask somebody about his shortcomings, and he'll often cover up the filthy truth by encasing it in a Lowy-esque shell of aspirational thinking. In psychological studies, this is sometimes attributed to social desirability bias. People tell researchers, not to mention friends and family, that they're better than they really are because they want people to like them. Or, more subtly, they want to tell themselves that they are the kind of person that people like. A 2008 review of the effect found that research subjects fib about almost every element of their identities, their competence at various tasks, their psychiatric condition, their exercise regimen, their emotions, their behavior toward partners, and their diet. Given time to reflect, People prefer to talk about the person they want to be, not the person they are. People mischaracterize their bad habits because they can. They fail to forecast their future behavior because they can't. Predicting anybody's future is difficult, even your own. It was especially difficult for avid newspaper readers in the 1920s and 1930s to foresee the whiz-bang technology just around the bend. It was a small box powered by cathode ray tubes that would supplant newspapers and radio on its way to becoming the most popular media product in American history. By the middle of the 20th century, large newspapers continued to grow in both page count and readers, having absorbed many small and specialized dailies. But they faced a new test, which proved more daunting to the future of reading than tabloids, radio, film, or even cars. In the 1950s, the television went from living room curiosity to household ubiquity. Less than 1% of homes owned a television set in 1948. One decade later, 83% did, and they sat in front of it for more than 5 hours a day. No personal technology, not the radio, the telephone, the car, the refrigerator, or indoor plumbing, had ever spread so quickly from household to household. Newspapers initially ignored the threat from television. Print journalism was far more fascinating, far more varied, and offers far greater possibility of financial reward, New York Daily News executive director Richard W. Clark said in 1947. New York Times executive editor Turner Catledge, writing in 1951, claimed he did not regard TV as a direct competitor of the type of newspaper we publish. Meanwhile, publishers hedged against the possibility that there might be something to TV after all, by owning 6 of its first 15 stations. Although it's easy to judge the publishers' misplaced confidence several decades later, they were comparing themselves to a television news product that was just plain awful. There was little original reporting on television, and the first generation of producers didn't understand how to make a good TV show. Rather, they knew how to put a good radio show on TV. But bad television didn't stop people from building channels, which quintupled in the 1950s, or from watching television. Between 1948 and 1955, a household's average time spent listening to the radio fell from 4.4 hours to 2.4 hours. It would be satisfyingly dramatic to report that a single news story marked the inflection point in television's transition from fringe to mainstream. No such event exists, but the story of a young California girl named Kathy Fiscus comes quite close. On a Friday afternoon in San Marino in April 1949, the young girl, with light curly hair and a giggly smile, fell into the narrow shaft of an abandoned water well. The city commandeered an arsenal of digging tools at the scene to rescue Kathy, drills, bulldozers, cranes, and dozens of floodlights from Hollywood studios. Reporters from the Los Angeles station KTLA covered the rescue attempt for 28 consecutive hours, and 10,000 people assembled to learn, sadly, that Kathy had died at the bottom of the well. The rescue effort was front page news for the Los Angeles Times, but the tragedy highlighted the ability of television to transport people to breaking news in a way that the printed word could never do. This was the first time that the cathode ray tube had out and out scooped the newspapers, recalled Will Fowler, a famous longtime Los Angeles reporter. 7 decades later, cable news remembers the lesson. Nothing on television captures the national attention like a relatable mystery that holds out the promise of a pat resolution. Who won the election? Who planned the attack? Where did the plane go? In the 1950s, several political events demonstrated the power of this curious little box. The 1951 Senate Committee to Investigate Organized Crime and General Douglas MacArthur's return to the United States were both transmitted to tens of millions of viewers. The 1952 Republican National Convention created the largest audience for a live television event ever to date, with 60 million viewers. Newsweek called it the Television Convention. In 1956, Dwight Eisenhower was so keen on the power of television as an empathetic medium that he hired a young television marketer from Gallup's old firm Young and Rubicam, in fact, to orchestrate the Republican National Convention and inject it with informality, feeling, and emotion. The 1960 presidential election featured the first televised debate, fatefully juxtaposing the regal air of John F. Kennedy with the moist mug of Richard Nixon. Today, the 1960 contest is widely considered the television election, but it would be a mistake to think that it was the first election inflected by television. By degrees, the country's leading media critics changed their tune about television news. It wasn't all terrible, merely often terrible, and occasionally exquisite. In 1961, Newton Minow, chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, delivered his famous address calling television a vast wasteland. But his speech was not as dire as its most well-known quote would suggest. In fact, the address included another line that ought to be similarly immortal. "When television is good, nothing is better," he said. What do people want to read? Is the question that kicks off this chapter. It's the question that motivated newspaper publishers to hire spies and made George Gallup a star. But the success of television suggests that the query is too narrow. The correct question would be, how do people want to experience news, entertainment, and storytelling, whether the medium is words, images, or sounds? Sometimes an upstart company will topple a legacy industry not with a superior product in the old market, but with an inferior product in a new market. Indeed, it turned out that the greatest threat to newspapers wasn't better newspapers. It was bad television. Television supplanted paper as the main source of news almost everywhere it was introduced. In the United States, the UK, Australia, and across continental Europe, newspapers sold per person plummeted in the second half of the 20th century. If television sapped newspapers' readership, the internet finally felled the dead tree business model. Like their physical delivery, newspapers are an economic bundle. The business section pays for the political reporting. The auto and real estate sections cross-subsidize the international investigations. But the internet uncrossed the subsidies. Sites like Craigslist, eBay, and Zillow offered more direct and accessible versions of the classified sections and real estate pages, and advertising fled print for other websites. If that wasn't enough, digital news has surreptitiously undermined paid news in a broader sense by creating an expectation that news should be free. There are now dozens of excellent advertising-only websites that have taken the place of legacy newspapers and magazines, but together, they have committed a kind of unintentional manslaughter of paid news by instructing a generation of readers that attention time alone can fund journalism. Internet news is evolving too. In the first stage, newspapers and magazines put their articles on the web, shoehorning the previous decade's content into the new medium, much like early television shows were essentially radio programs plopped in front of a camera. In the second stage, aggregators took over. Readers learned they didn't have to go to a website to learn about the morning's news. They could type keywords into the Google search bar and the news would blink into view. They could visit portals like Dig and Reddit, which ranked and contextualized links from several publishers. Or they could log on to social media like Facebook and Twitter to read articles posted by their friends and peers. The rise of the aggregators diluted the power of websites and homepages, as readers learned to go to Google or Reddit for questions previously reserved for the local newspaper. The center of power in publishing was shifting from news brands to discovery platforms. quite like it did in another age of abundant words, when the Book of the Month Club helped readers strategically sample from the surfeit of new titles. Today, social media has replaced the morning paper as the first stop for many young people seeking news about the world. Young people between 18 and 34, alternatively called millennials, Gen Y,